listener production.
Hi, I'm Amy Dale, and I'm not a lawyer. But since working at the Law Society, I've met and worked with plenty of them. And I've also met countless people who need help understanding the law and, more importantly, knowing how to find the right lawyer. That's why we've created this podcast, to help make the law accessible for you, for me, for everyone. No jargon, no law speak, I promise. Just me diving into the most common legal problems to help you make the best decisions possible. Welcome to Lawfully Explained. Whether it's a bricks and mortar small business or an online side hustle, there is so much that small business owners must navigate without the luxury of HR departments or in-house legal counsel. So from negotiating contracts to salaries to what to do if things turn sour, I'm joined by experienced commercial lawyer and former small business owner, Jonathan Kaplan. Jonathan, welcome.
Only a pleasure.
I just want to know, first of all, how do I know what type of business I would need to be setting up, whether or not I'm a company, a sole trader, small business? Like, talk me through what each of those mean.
So the options are really either sole trader or sole proprietor, if you want to call it that. This is really small operators. It's a commonly used structure. There are no significant costs to setting up a sole trader. Registering the business name is probably under $100 in Victoria. And the sole trader is personally liable for all the costs. Now, a sole trader would pay income tax at personal income tax rates. But of course, the disadvantage is that personal assets are at risk if the business venture fails.
So you've got to put quite a bit on the line as a sole trader.
Correct. So the loss of personal assets could include family home or motor vehicles or whatever.
Oh, wow.
If the person is a sole trader. Now, the other structure, it's if you're going into business with a partner. So they're going to business either under their own name or under a registered business name. Partnership liability is also unlimited. So even where partners incur debt, or one partner incurs debt without knowledge of the other partner is also liable. So the obligation between partners is not only good faith, but the utmost good faith.
Mm-hmm.
So choose your partners very carefully. So the next and probably the most commonly used vehicle is a company. It's a separate legal entity, owns the assets, incurs the liability. The shareholders appoint the directors who manage the company's business. And the company essentially provides protection to the shareholders and directors in relation to their personal assets. Now, the setup costs for a company are higher. So you're looking at around about $1,000, plus, if need be, the usual company accounts, and that can be $2,000-$3,000 or thereabouts. Mm. So the next vehicle, and probably the last vehicle, is the discretionary family trust. And that allows one to distribute income to family members who are on a lower tax rate. And it also provides some protection against bankruptcy and insolvency. But the setup costs for that are also a bit higher, because not only do you have, if you've got a corporate trustee, that is a company as the trustee of the trust, you've got those costs, which I've mentioned a moment ago, and you've also got the costs of setting up a trust deed. So it sort of bumps up a bit. But sometimes, look, it's best to go with the best vehicle. And the only way you can decide which the best vehicle is to get proper legal and accounting advice at the time that you're going into the business.
Yeah, obviously, I imagine that doing this before you start can save a lot of heartache later on. I'm going to jump back to, I suppose, in the beginning, before it does come to being a business. How do I, if I've got a great idea for something like a store or something that I think is a great idea, is there anywhere I can go and register that? And can I copyright an idea?
What you can do is, if you've developed a product that you believe will be a profitable venture, you can register, if it's a patent, if it's an idea, you can go to IP Australia, which is a federal government body that deals with registrations. And it's got a very comprehensive website and quite user-friendly, actually. So if you've got this idea and you want to protect it, you can register a patent, which is a legally enforceable right for the device or substance, method or process, whatever it is. But in order to be able to be successful in the registration, the invention must be new, it must be useful, it must be inventive or innovative. That's the sort of legal definition of it.
Yeah, you can't just register a cafe, a keep cup or something like a sort of a new coffee shop or something like that. It has to be something that's a new invention that is not being done by the market more broadly.
Correct. And once registered, you've got exclusive rights to that invention. But you need to be aware that if you do demonstrate it in public or sell or discuss your invention in public before you file your application for your patent, you might not get that patent because then it's out in the open.
Oh, and then does that become, it's almost been like put into the arena of just great ideas that anybody can then tap into?
Correct. You don't want to give away your secrets.
Yeah, don't brag until you filed the paperwork.
The important thing to remember is if you are going to discuss it with your employees or business partners, they should be required to sign a non-disclosure agreement, or otherwise known as a confidentiality agreement, which will then prohibit them from discussing it if you need to get feedback from other parties in your organization. Now, you can also register a trademark if that's your logo, or, you know, if you look at the Coca-Cola logo, that's a registered trademark, and God help you if you try and use it.
Don't try and use the Coke symbol. Things will go wrong. What about for people where it's not an idea, but it's more, you know, I want to start a cafe, I want to start a restaurant or a bar or something like that. Where could someone go to register a business like that?
Yes. So assuming you're a sole trader or a partnership and you want to register your business name, you'll first need to sign up on the ASIC Connect account, which is the Australian Securities Investment Commission. Now, you must obviously have an ABN before you do that. But once you've registered that, you need to establish whether that business name that you're hoping to register is not registered by someone else. So you can do that through a business name search. And the website will guide you through this search. If it is something that isn't registered already, then you can register it. And you lodge that through your ASIC Connect account. Mm. But a company, for example, does not necessarily need to register a business name because it is in the name of the company. But if they do want to use the name of the company without PTY Limited or anything like that, it's a good idea for them to register that name. And the reason is because if you ever sell the business, the person who buys the business would want that name. Once it's registered, it's very easy to transfer. It's quite a painful exercise trying to do that right at the end.
So say I want to open a cafe restaurant, and I might be a fan of McDonald's, but say I want to call my cafe restaurant something like Jack Johnald's. And I say, oh no, I've got a reason for this. Like, this was my grandfather's name. How similar can a name be before another more famous business might step in and say, nah, way too close?
Well, I probably wouldn't print all your documentation at that stage. If the name is so similar that it's classified as trying to pass off your business as someone else's business, you would probably find yourself at the end of a letter from McDonald's solicitors. It's probably not a good idea to try and use a similar name to someone else's name, especially if you're selling hamburgers.
And I'm pretty sure that McDonald's could afford more expensive lawyers than I could.
Very deep pockets. I wouldn't muck around with them.
If someone was trying to register a name and it was registered to a business that no longer exists, like if that business shuts down, is the name given up? Like, could I then say, well, that business isn't operating anymore, so I can take the name, or would I still have to come up with a new name?
Yeah, business names do lapse and after a period, and or if you don't pay your registration fees, and then that business name is up for grabs again.
Fantastic. So say, for an example, I want to open up a bar. And I know that I can't just open up my shopfront and be like, hi guys, selling wine, who wants to come in, have a drink? There's checks and balances that need to happen before then. Where can I check what rules might apply? Now, obviously liquor licenses are maybe a bit more obvious, but what about things like trading hours?
Okay. Liquor licensing laws are state-based. So each state has its own requirements as far as trading is concerned. But generally, trading hours for restaurant and cafe licenses, as I say, apply on a state-based basis, which cover certain public holidays and when people can't trade, when they can trade. There's certain businesses that are exempt. There are certain changes to the liquor licensing laws which came into effect on the 15th of March, And these changes can be found on the website of the Victorian Gambling and Casino Control Commission. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it is what it is. It's also quite a friendly, user-friendly website and takes you through the process of liquor licensing. But with liquor licensing, it's always a good idea to engage a solicitor who's experienced in those applications, because if your application is rejected, it's very difficult to try and unscramble the egg.
Yeah, you can't unmix that cocktail.
But on liquor licensing, it is a prerequisite that before you do apply for a liquor license, you do have to do a course called Licensee's First Step. So that gives you the background to how you have to behave as a licensee. And anyone involved in the service of alcohol needs to undertake a course in responsible service of alcohol. In relation to businesses, non-liquor businesses, there are certain other licenses that you would need to have. And those would, for example, be Food Act registration, which you do through a local council to come and inspect the business and make sure that you...
There's no rats or anything.
Safe handling of food, footpath trading permits, you'd need work cover registration and so forth. And then, you know, your landlord might require that you take out public liability insurance, and you might even want to take out your own business interruption insurance in case your business is interrupted by some unforeseen circumstances, or you might have theft or damage or flood or whatever.
One thing I did want to also chat to you about is franchisees. So what rights do they have when it comes to the running of a business?
The franchisee has to run the business according to the franchisor's requirements. And that's usually detailed in the franchise agreement that they would be subscribing to. So if you're asking about the franchisor and franchisee, the franchisor largely controls how the franchisee runs the business. They also control the name and the brand and the business system that the franchisee is going to use. The franchisee bears the financial risk for the franchise business, and they pay money to the franchisor to undertake that operation. So that's really how it works. The brand or the system is provided to the franchisee to sell the products or services that have been franchised to them.
So this is why McDonald's looks the same everywhere.
Correct. But also the franchising code of conduct applies. So that document provides assistance to both franchisors and franchisees where it addresses some of the problems that people might encounter in the conduct of the operation. Now, if someone signs a franchise agreement, there is a cooling off period where they can terminate the agreement within 14 days of signing. That's just one of the provisions that exist there. But once again, the ACCC do have a user-friendly website where, under the heading of Franchising Code of Conduct, there is a free online course that they provide where you can go through that course and see what steps to take when things go wrong as a franchisee.
What happens if I start a business with a partner or a friend and that relationship breaks down?
All right. So the golden rule is don't go into partnership with anyone.
Just go it alone. Just lone wolf it.
Yeah, if they're not reliable or compromising or trustworthy, you could be in trouble. But look, always ensure that you have a written partnership agreement. Once again, not something that you've taken off a website somewhere, but prepared by a solicitor, and that it does include a mechanism for dissolution, for example, buy-sell agreements, and also that it has a good dispute resolution clause. Some years ago, I acted for a partner who had two other partners. There was no partnership agreement. The relationship went sour, and it took 3 years and enormous legal fees before the matter was settled and the partnership was eventually dissolved. And all they needed to do was spend a few thousand dollars
at the start
on a partnership agreement, and that would have provided all the correct mechanisms to deal with any disputes. So, look, it happens that two supposedly good friends go into partnership and partnership ends in bitter dispute, and that's because the responsibilities of the parties haven't been properly documented and no exit mechanism has been provided.
Turning to having started the business and everything's going well, and I'll say for this example, say that it's some kind of a food business, so a cafe or a restaurant or something like that. What are my rights if, say, a neighbour complains to me about my business making noise. Like, I know obviously deliveries of things like that can arrive early in the morning or bottles get cleaned up late at night on the other side. How do you handle a situation like that?
Once again, in Victoria, they've got laws that control noise, including planning and local laws. So noise from businesses, they must minimise the risk of harm to human health as a result of noise from their premises, and they must comply with these noise limits. They just got to make sure that any noise from their activities doesn't unreasonably impact the local community. For example, if deliveries are before 7 o'clock in the morning or after 10 o'clock at night, or you have a pub and every night at midnight you decide to take the bins from the pub and dump them into a skip and you have the sound of crashing bottles, the noise is going to be a problem for neighbours. And look, noise complaints can be complex. If it's safe to do so, the EPA encourages people in the first instance, where appropriate, to speak to your people that are making the noise or making the complaint at least. Talking about the noise can often, you know, you can work something out.
Mm.
But if all else fails, try your local council. Another alternative is to try and have the dispute resolved by mediation, which the Dispute Settlement Centre, for example, in Victoria, or you can request the President of the Law Institute to appoint a mediator.
What about with food businesses? What about smells? And I mean, I'm not sure if what the situation is in Victoria. I know I do recall one case in Sydney that was about the smell of bacon that was coming from a cafe that was in an apartment complex, and there were people who lived there who were vegan and were up in arms about the constant smell of bacon, which obviously a lot of meat eaters adore the smell of bacon. But in a situation like that, I suppose noise is a little bit more of a straightforward kind of, most people know what a loud noise is. But what about something like a smell?
I think probably similar provisions apply. I mean, you would go to your local council and say, look, the ventilation in the restaurant is not adequate.
And too much bacon.
Get them to do something, maybe muffins smell better, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it would be something you'd have to either sort out with a tenant who's causing the problem or speak to the landlord. Maybe they can raise it with the relevant council. They can raise it with a tenant. But I think the first port of call there would be the local council who have control over food issues.
What if people invest in my business and it goes badly? Do I have to pay them back?
Well, it depends on the basis on which they invest. If it's an investment for a share of the profit, for example, $100,000 for 20% of the profit, that would probably be classified as risk capital investment. And if the business did go sour, well, that's unfortunately bad luck. But if the investment is in the form of a loan with interest, unless the loan is secured by a mortgage over your real estate or there's registration of a security interest over your personal goods under the Personal Property Security Act, the lender would be at a big disadvantage in trying to recover. So if they don't have any security, it's very tough to get something back.
Mm.
Because you'd have to wait for liquidation and or bankruptcy proceeding and see if there's anything left over in the spoils.
What about with staff?
Staff is a different situation. It's imperative, first of all, if your business is going badly, that you inform your staff as soon as possible. Don't keep them in the dark. If it's clear that the business can't survive, then the best course of action would be to once again seek legal advice. You might end up going filing for bankruptcy if there's no other option. For example, negotiating with your suppliers or negotiating with your landlord, explaining the situation. But the Australian government, just in the normal case, does provide financial assistance to cover certain unpaid employment entitlements to employees who have lost their job due to the liquidation or bankruptcy. And that's provided under what's called the Fair Entitlements Guarantee, which is a legislated safety net scheme. Last resort with assistance available for eligible employees. Now, it covers unpaid wages for 13 weeks, unpaid annual leave, long service leave, payment in lieu of notice, redundancy pay and so forth. But the employee needs to fall within a certain category. So the claim has got to be lodged within a prescribed period. a job's got to be lost through insolvency of the employer, and they need to be an Australian citizen or permanent resident, permanent visa holder.
I want to ask you about advertising rules and if there are rules that someone who is setting up a small business has to follow. So if I want to say that my cafe makes the best coffee in town or something like that, I make, you know, Australia's best smoothies, can I be forced to prove that?
Well, any statement representing your products or services must be true, accurate and able to be substantiated.
Because I used to go to a cafe that said that, and he said that he had won a barista competition, and then it was right down the bottom of his banner that it had been like 10 years ago.
I'll just give you a brief rundown of what you can and can't do.
Yep, talk me through it.
So it's illegal for a business to make statements that are incorrect or likely to create a false impression. And that includes advertisements or statements in media or print or radio, social media, etc., or on your packaging, and also a statement made by a person representing your business. So they can't make statements that are incorrect. Your business can't make false or misleading statements about quality or value or price or the benefits of goods or services or any associated guarantee or warranty about the product. So it doesn't matter that it was unintentional, but if it's false and misleading, so be it. So your example about smoothies, if your smoothies say your customers, it'll help your customers lose weight, that may be false and misleading unless it's true and accurate and can be substantiated. It might be a long and rocky road to try and prove that, but that's what it is. So the overall impression created by your conduct is what's important.
So I can't say, yes, this, my smoothie will do this. Oh, but also you have to like go for a run 6 times a week. Like I didn't mention that part.
That's right. Now you mentioned the coffee issue. There is a concept in law called puffery or puffing.
I love that. Puffery.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with smoking. And it's a term to describe wildly exaggerated or vague claims about a product or service that no one could possibly treat seriously. So if you have a restaurant that says, we've got the best steaks on earth or we serve the best coffee in Melbourne, they're generally not considered as misleading because, I mean, you'll never be able to establish that.
It's Melbourne. Yeah. There's great coffee on every street.
Absolutely.
I'm going to ask you a question, and it's certainly a phrase that will send shivers down the spine of anybody who's worked in retail or hospitality. Is the customer always right?
Well, that's not entirely correct.
I knew it.
There are wrong customers. If the customer was always right, you'd lose money without making a profit. And employees need to know how to handle them accordingly. And look, it's a slippery slope. But yeah, a customer is sometimes wrong.
In your former life, owning businesses, how far that was, or if that was during the era of Google reviews and sums and those sorts of opinion sharing platforms. But what if someone leaves a false and damaging online review? Can I request that that's taken down?
Well, first of all, I'm happy to say that I don't recall ever having a bad review. I don't recall having a good review either.
That doesn't matter. No bad reviews. 5-star Jonathan.
Look, if a bad review is a customer's honest opinion of the experience and they tell the truth, then there's no legal action you can take against them, of course. For example, a food writer, they'd merely be expressing their opinion. They thought the food at your restaurant was overpriced and the steak was overcooked. Well, that's what they thought. That was their opinion. If the damaging review was by a customer, you should take steps to, first of all, find out the identity of the customer who posted the review and then confirm that they were a customer of yours, because you can sometimes have opposition businesses posting bad reviews. It's happened very often. But
wow.
If you have confirmed that the person was a customer, you should take a few steps. First of all, you might want to comment on the review they've made. And if you trawl through the comments on perhaps TripAdvisor or Zomato or one of those, you might see that someone has posted something and the owner of the business has posted something along the lines, I'm really sorry you had a bad experience, da-da-da. So that sometimes alleviates it. But if the review is not true and it's offensive, you could go back to the platform and say to them, look, this is absolute nonsense. Can you please remove it? They don't always do that. But if you have a strong enough case, they'll listen to you. But if they didn't honestly hold that opinion when they published the review, then that would potentially entitle a claim for defamation.
Before I let you go, I want to ask, what do you suggest people do before starting a business that often most people don't think of?
Well, I mean, I think what you need to do is do your research. Do your research, make sure you're in a compatible industry. It's heaven if you get it right, and it's absolute hell if you get it wrong. You've invested a lot of money, or you propose to invest a lot of money. I would suggest write a business plan. One of the things that you can get online, and there are heaps of them, are templates for business plans. You can search Google and you'll find them. Do proper budgets. Do forecasts. What's your break-even point? You can do an Excel spreadsheet. If I'm going to do so much turnover, what profit or loss am I going to make? And then hopefully you'll get to the point at the end of the spreadsheet where you've actually made that money and you're making a good profit. So, plug in what your anticipated expenses are going to be, your rent, your staff, your food cost, et cetera, if it's a cafe. And that will give you some idea of certainly all your expenses and what you expect your turnover to be. But if you're dependent on foot traffic, you should adopt the real estate agent 3 P's. Position, position, position. Because that's, if you're going to depend on foot traffic, well, you need to be in the right spot.
Mm.
If it's a destination business that you're going to have, you're going to make sure that you've got a good concept, because if people are going to have to go out of their way, it's going to be need to be something that they're after.
And when people are thinking about starting a business, and obviously at that point in time, they're probably thinking a lot about their finances and saving costs where they can, but where can a lawyer help in the early stages, and where is that really worth the investment of paying for a lawyer up front and putting that cost at the start to avoid these sorts of heartaches later on?
I would suggest you speak to a financial advisor or an accountant who will take you through what your likely scenario will be. As I said when I spoke about a spreadsheet a moment ago, they will be able to guide you through the income and expenditure position and what it's likely to be if it doesn't get there, if it doesn't get to the break-even point. The lawyer will really be the person you need to speak to if you're going into a franchise agreement or negotiating a lease with a landlord, or if you're starting a business with a friend. Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things you need to be very conscious about when you're starting a business with a friend. You need to know that they're trustworthy and so forth, but you also need to know their work ethics. You don't want to go into business with a partner who takes long lunches and arrives at work at 10:30 in the morning and you carrying the can for them. So those are the kind of things. But if you're thinking of going into business with a friend, take a step back and say to yourself, is this the right working relationship for you?
Well, what can begin as a great idea can turn into a really successful business, but there are a lot of things that you need to know before you go into it. And Jonathan Kaplan, as an experienced commercial lawyer and also someone who has formerly run businesses yourself, you have been such an informative and helpful guest in helping people understand where the rules are and how to follow them. So thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
What you heard in today's episode is not intended as a substitute for legal advice from a qualified professional. I'm not even a lawyer, remember? So if you are looking for legal advice based on your individual circumstances, head to lawfullyexplained.com.au and find the solicitor who is right for you. Lawfully Explained is a listener production in partnership with the Law Society of New South Wales and with support from the Law Institute of Victoria. Hosted by me, Amy Dale. Production by Emily Toccato. Audio production by Mitch Calladine. And executive producer is Todd Stevens. Listener.